One by one, he empties the chamber of bullets. They almost jingle as they hit the floor, and then roll, coming to rest against the toes of Tobias's shoes. He picks up the middle gun and puts a bullet into the first slot. Then he moves the three guns on the floor, around and around, until my eyes can't follow the middle gun anymore. I lose track of which one holds the bullet. He picks up the guns and offers one to Tori, and another one to Harrison. I try to think of the attack simulation, of what it did to the abnegation, all the gray-clothed innocents lying dead on the street. There weren't even enough abnegation left to take care of the bodies, so most of them are probably still there. And that would not have been possible without Eric. I think of the Candor boy, shot without a second's hesitation, how stiff he was as he hit the ground next to me. Maybe we are not the ones deciding if Eric lives or dies. Maybe he is the one who decided that, when he did all those terrible things. But it's still hard to breathe. I look at him without malice, without hatred, and without fear. The rings in his face shine, and a lock of dirty hair falls into his eyes. "Wait," he says. "I have a request." "We don't take requests from criminals," says Tori. She's standing on one leg, and has been for the past few minutes. She sounds tired. She probably wants to get this over with so she can sit down again. To her, this execution is just an inconvenience. "I am a leader of Dauntless," he says, "and all I want is for Four to be the one who fires that bullet." "Why?" Tobias says. "So you can live with the guilt," Eric replies, "of knowing that you usurped me and then shot me in the head." I think I understand. He wants to see people break. He always wanted to, ever since he set up the camera in my execution room when I nearly drowned, and probably long before then. He believes that if Tobias has to kill him, he will see that before he dies. "Sick. There won't be any guilt," says Tobias. "Then you'll have no problem doing it." Eric smiles again. Tobias picks up one of the bullets. "Tell me," says Eric quietly, "because I've always wondered. Is it your daddy who shows up in every fear landscape you've ever gone through?" Tobias puts the bullet into an empty chamber without looking up. "You didn't like that question?" Eric says. "What? Afraid the Dauntless are going to change their minds about you? Realize that even though you've only got four fears, you're still a coward?" He straightens in the chair and puts his hands on the armrests. Tobias holds his gun out from his left shoulder. "Eric," he says, "be brave." He squeezes the trigger. I shut my eyes. Chapter 24. Blood is a strange color. It's darker than you expect it to be. I stare down at Marlene's hand, which is wrapped around my arm. Her fingernails are short and jagged. She bites them. She pushes me forward, and I must be walking, because I can feel myself moving. But in my mind, I stand before Eric, and he is still alive. He died just like Will did. Slumped just like Will did. I thought the swollen feeling in my throat would go away once he was dead, but it didn't. I have to take deep, hard breaths to get enough air. Good thing the crowd around me is so loud that no one can hear me. We march toward the doors. At the front of the pack is Harrison, carrying Tori on his back like a child. She laughs, her arms wrapped around his neck. Tobias sets his hand on my back. I know because I see him come up behind me and do it, not because I feel it. I don't feel anything at all. The doors open from the outside. We stop short of stampeding Jack Kang and the group of Candor that followed him here. "What have you done?" he says. "I was just told that Eric is missing from his holding cell."
"He was under our jurisdiction," says Tori. "We gave him a trial and executed him. You should be thanking us."
"Why?" Jack's face turns red. Blood is darker than blush, even though one consists of the other. "Why should I be thanking you?"
"Because you wanted him to be executed too, right?
since he murdered one of your children?
Tori tilts her head, her eyes wide, innocent.
Well, we took care of it for you. And now, if you'll excuse us, we're leaving.
What? Leaving?
Jack splutters. If we leave, he will be incapable of fulfilling two of the three demands Max had of him. The thought terrifies him, and it is all over his face.
I can't let you do that, he says.
You don't let us do anything, says Tobias. If you don't step aside, we will be forced to walk over you instead of past you.
Didn't you come here to find allies?
Jack scowls.
If you do this, we will side with Erudite, I promise you. And you will never find an ally in us again. You...
We don't need you as an ally, says Tori. We're dauntless. Everyone shouts. And somehow their screams pierce the haze in my mind. The entire crowd presses forward at once. The candor in the corridor yelp and dive out of the way as we spill into the hallway like a burst pipe. Dauntless water spreading to fill the empty space. Marlene's grip on my arm breaks. I run down the stairs, chasing the heels of the Dauntless in front of me, ignoring the jostle of elbows and all the shouts around me. I feel like I'm an initiate again, storming the stairs of the hub right after the choosing ceremony. My legs burn. But that is all right. We reach the lobby. A group of Candor and Erudite are waiting there, including the blonde divergent woman who got dragged to the elevators by her hair, the girl I helped escape, and Kara. They watch the Dauntless stream past them with helpless looks on their faces. Kara spots me and grabs my arm, wrenching me back.
Where are you all going?
Dauntless headquarters. I try to pull my arm free, but she won't let go. I don't look at her face. I can't look at her right now.
Go to Amity, I say. They promise safety to anyone who wants it. You won't be safe here.
She releases me, almost pushing me away from her in the process. Outside, the ground feels slick beneath my sneakers, and my sack of clothes thumps against my back as I slow to a jog. Rain sprinkles my head and my back. My feet splash through puddles, soaking my pant legs. I smell wet pavement, and pretend that this is all there is. I stand at the railing overlooking the chasm. Water hits the wall beneath me, but it doesn't come high enough to splash my shoes. 100 yards away, Bud passes out paintball guns. Someone else passes out paintballs. Soon the hidden corners of Dauntless headquarters will be coated in multicolored paint, blocking the lenses of the surveillance cameras.
Hey, Triss, Zeke says, joining me at the railing.
His eyes are red and swollen, but his mouth is curled into a small smile.
Hey, you made it.
Yeah. We waited until Shauna was stable and then took her here. He rubs one of his eyes with his thumb. I didn't want to move her, but wasn't safe with Candor anymore. Obviously.
How is she?
Dunno. She's gonna survive it, but the nurse thinks she might be paralyzed from the waist down. And that wouldn't bother me, but... He lifts a shoulder. How can she be dauntless if she can't walk? I stare across the pit, where some dauntless children chase each other up the path, hurling paintballs at the walls. One of them breaks and splatters the stone with yellow. I think of what Tobias told me when we spent the night with the factionless, about the older dauntless leaving the faction because they were no longer physically capable of staying in it. I think of Candor's rhyming song, which calls us the cruelest faction.
She can, I say.
Triss, she won't even be able to move around.
Sure she will.
I look up at him.
She can get a wheelchair, and someone can push her up the paths in the pit. And there's an elevator in the building up there.
I point above our heads. She doesn't need to be able to walk to slide down the zip line or fire a gun.
She won't want me to push her.
His voice cracks a little.
She won't want me to lift her or carry her.
She'll have to get over it then. Are you going to let her drop out of Dauntless for a stupid reason like not being able to walk? Zeke is quiet for a few seconds. His eyes shift over my face and he squints, as if weighing and measuring me.
Then he turns and bends and wraps his arms around me. It's been so long since someone hugged me that I stiffen. Then I relax and let the gesture force warmth into my body, which is chilled by damp clothing. I'm gonna go shoot things, he says as he pulls away. Want to come? I shrug and chase him across the pit floor. Bud hands each of us a paintball gun, and I load mine. Its weight, shape, and material are so different from a revolver that I have no trouble holding it. We mostly got the pit and the underground covered, Bud says. Bud, you should tackle the pyre.
The pyre?
Bud points up at the glass building above us. The sight pierces me like a needle. The last time I stood in this spot and stared up at this ceiling, I was on a mission to destroy the simulation. I was with my father. Zeke is already on his way up the path. I force myself to follow him, one foot and then the other. It's difficult to walk because it's difficult to breathe, but somehow I manage. By the time I reach the stairs, the pressure on my chest is almost gone. Once we're in the pyre, Zeke lifts up his gun and aims at one of the cameras near the ceiling. He fires, and green paint sprays across one of the windows, missing the camera lens.
Ooh, I say, wincing. Ouch.
Yeah, I'd like to see you do it perfectly the first time.
Would you?
I lift my own gun, propping it up on my left shoulder instead of my right. The gun feels unfamiliar in my left hand, but I can't bear its weight with my right yet. Through the scope, I find the camera, and then squint to stare at the lens. A voice whispers in my head. Inhale, aim, exhale, fire. It takes me a few seconds to realize it's Tobias's voice, because he's the one who taught me to shoot. I squeeze the trigger, and the paintball hits the camera, spraying blue paint across the lens.
There. Now you have.
With the wrong hand, too. Zeke mutters something under his breath that doesn't sound pleasant.
Hey!
Shouts a cheerful voice. Marlene pokes her head above the glass floor. Paint is smeared across her forehead, giving her a purple eyebrow. With a wicked smile, she aims at Zeke, hitting his leg and then at me. The paintball hits my arm, stinging. Marlene laughs and ducks under the glass. Zeke and I look at each other, and then run after Marlene. She laughs as she sprints down the path, weaving through a crowd of kids. I shoot at her and hit the wall instead. Marlene fires at a boy near the railing, Hector, Lynn's little brother. He looks shocked at first, but then fires back, hitting the person next to Marlene. Popping sounds fill the air as everyone in the pit starts to fire at one another, young and old. The camera's momentarily forgotten. I charge down the path, surrounded by laughter and shouting. We cluster together to form teams and then turn against one another. By the time the fight dies down, my clothes are more paint-colored than black. I decide to keep the shirt, to remind me why I chose Dauntless in the first place. Not because they are perfect, but because they are alive. Because they are free.
Chapter 25.
Someone raids the Dauntless kitchens and heats up the imperishables kept there, so we have a warm dinner that night. I sit at the same table I used to claim with Christina, Al, and Will. From the moment I sit down, I feel a lump in my throat. How is it that only half of us are left? I feel responsible for that. My forgiveness could have saved Al, but I withheld it. My clear-headedness could have spared Will, but I could not summon it. Before I can sink too far into my guilt, Uriah drops his tray next to me. It is loaded with beef stew and chocolate cake. I stare at the cake pile.
There was cake?
I say, looking at my own plate, which is more sensibly stocked than Uriah's.
Yeah. Someone just brought it out.
Found a couple boxes of the mix in the back and baked it, he says. You can have a few bites of mine.
A few bites?
So you're planning on eating that mountain of cake by yourself?
Yes.
He looks confused.
Why?
Never mind. Christina sits across the table as far away from me as she can get. Zeke puts his tray down next to her. We are soon joined by Lynn, Hector, and Marlene.
I see a flash of movement under the table, and see Marlene's hand meet Uriah's over his knee. Their fingers twist together. They are both clearly trying to look casual, but they sneak looks at each other. To Marlene's left, Lynn looks like she just tasted something sour. She shovels food into her mouth. "Where's the fire?" Uriah asks her. "You're going to hurl if you keep eating that fast." Lynn scowls at him. "I'm going to hurl anyway, with you two making eyes at each other all the time." Uriah's ears turn red. "What are you talking about?" "I'm not an idiot, and neither is anyone else, so why don't you just make out with her and get it over with?" Uriah looks stunned. Marlene, however, glares at Lynn, leans over and kisses Uriah firmly on the mouth, her fingers sliding around his neck, under the collar of his shirt. I notice that all the peas have fallen off my fork, which was on its way to my mouth. Lynn grabs her tray and storms away from the table. "What was that all about?" says Zeke. "Don't ask me," says Hector. "She's always angry about something. I've stopped trying to keep track." Uriah's and Marlene's faces are still close together, and they are still smiling. I force myself to stare at my plate. It is so strange to see two people you have known separately joined together, though I have watched it happen before. I hear a squeak as Christina scratches her plate with her fork idly. "Four!" Zeke calls out, beckoning. He looks relieved. "Come here, there's room." Tobias rests his hand on my good shoulder. A few of his knuckles are split, and the blood looks fresh. "Sorry, I can't stay." He leans down and says, "Can I borrow you for a while?" I get up, waving a goodbye to everyone at the table who is paying attention, which is just Zeke, really, because Christina and Hector are staring at their plates, and Uriah and Marlene are talking quietly. Tobias and I walk out of the cafeteria. "Where are we going?" "The train," he says. "I have a meeting, and I want you there to help me read the situation." We walk up one of the paths that lines the pit walls toward the stairs that lead us to the pyre. "Why do you need me to—" "Because you're better at it than I am?" I don't have a response to that. We ascend the stairs and cross the glass floor. On our way out, we walk through the dank room in which I faced my fear landscape. Judging by the syringe on the floor, someone has been there recently. "Did you go through your fear landscape today?" I say. "What makes you say that?" His dark eyes skirt mine. He pushes the front door open, and the summer air swims around me. There is no wind. "Your knuckles are cut up, and someone's been using that room." "This is exactly what I mean. You're far more perceptive than most." He checks his watch. "They told me to catch the one leaving at 8:05. Come on." I feel a surge of hope. Maybe we won't argue this time. Maybe things will finally get better between us. We walk to the tracks. The last time we did this, he wanted to show me that the lights were on in the erudite compound. Wanted to tell me that erudite was planning an attack on abnegation. Now, I get the sense we are about to meet with the factionless. "Perceptive enough to know you're evading the question," I say. He sighs. "Yes. I went through my fear landscape. I wanted to see if it had changed." "And it has. Hasn't it?" He brushes a stray hair away from his face and avoids my eyes. I didn't know his hair was so thick. It was hard to tell when it was buzzed short. Abnegation hair. But now it's 2 inches long and almost hangs over his forehead. It makes him look less threatening, more like the person I've come to know in private. "Yes," he says, "but the number is still the same." I hear the train horn blasting to my left, but the light fixed to the first car is not on. Instead, it slides over the rails like some hidden creeping thing. "Fifth car back!" he shouts. We both break into a sprint. I find the fifth car and grab the handle on the side with my left hand, pulling as hard as I can. I try to swing my legs inside, but they don't quite make it. They are dangerously close to the wheels. I shriek and scrape my knee against the floor as I yank myself inside. Tobias gets in after me and crouches by my side. I clutch my knee and grit my teeth. "Here, let me see," he says. He pushes my jeans up my leg and over my knee. His fingers leave streaks of cold on my skin, invisible to the eye, and I think about wrapping his shirt around my fist and pulling him in to kiss me. I think about pressing myself against him, but I can't, because all our secrets would keep a space between us. My knee is red with blood. It's shallow. It'll heal quickly, he says. I nod. The pain is already subsiding. He rolls my jeans so they will stay up. I lie back staring at the ceiling. So is he still in your fear landscape? I say. It looks like someone lit a match behind his eye. Yes. But not in the same way. He told me once that his fear landscape hadn't changed since he first went through it, during his initiation. So if it has, even in a small way, that's something. You're in it, though. He frowns at his hands. Instead of having to shoot that woman, like I used to, I have to watch you die. And there's nothing I can do to stop it. His hands shake. I try to think of something helpful to say. I'm not going to die. But I don't know that. We live in a dangerous world, and I am not so attached to life that I will do anything to survive. I can't reassure him. He checks his watch. They'll be here any minute. I get up and see Evelyn and Edward standing next to the tracks. They run before the train passes them, and jump in with almost as little trouble as Tobias. They must have been practicing. Edward smirks at me. Today his eye patch has a big blue X stitched over it. Hello, Evelyn says. She looks only at Tobias as she says it, like I'm not even there. Nice meeting location, says Tobias. It is almost dark now, so I see only shadows of buildings against a dark blue sky, and a few glowing lights near the lake that must belong to Erudite headquarters. The train takes a turn it doesn't usually take, left, away from the glow of Erudite and into the abandoned part of the city. I can tell by the growing quiet in the car that it is slowing down. It seems safest, says Evelyn. So you wanted to meet? Yes. I'd like to discuss an alliance. An alliance? Repeats Edward. And who gave you the authority to do that? He's a dauntless leader, I say. He has the authority. Edward raises his eyebrows, looking impressed. Evelyn's eyes finally shift to me, but only for a second before she smiles at Tobias again. Interesting, she says. And is she also a dauntless leader? No, he says. She's here to help me decide whether or not to trust you. Evelyn purses her lips. Part of me wants to thumb my nose at her and say, ha! But I settle for a small smile. We will, of course, agree to an alliance. Under a certain set of conditions, Evelyn says. A guaranteed and equal place in whatever government forms after Erudite is destroyed, and full control over Erudite data after the attack. Clearly, what are you going to do with the Erudite data? I interrupt her. Obviously, we will destroy it. The only way to deprive the Erudite of power is to deprive them of knowledge. My first instinct is to tell her she's a fool. But something stops me. Without the simulation technology, without the data they had about all the other factions, without their focus on technological advancement, the attack on abnegation would not have happened. My parents would be alive. Even if we managed to kill Janine, could the Erudite be trusted not to attack and control us again? I'm not sure. What would we receive in return under those terms? Tobias says. Our much-needed manpower in order to take Erudite headquarters, and an equal place in government with us. I am sure that Tori would also request the right to rid the world of Janine Matthews, he says in a low voice. I raise my eyebrows. I didn't know that Tori's hatred of Janine was common knowledge. Or maybe it isn't. He must know things about her that others don't, now that he and Tori are leaders. I'm sure that could be arranged, Evelyn replies. I don't care who kills her. I just want her dead. Tobias glances at me. I wish I could tell him why I feel so conflicted. explain to him why I, of all people, have reservations about burning erudite to the ground, so to speak. But I would not know how to say it, even if I had the time to. He turns toward Evelyn.
Then we are agreed, he says. He extends his hand and she shakes it.
We should convene in a week's time, she says. In neutral territory. Most of the abnegation have graciously agreed to let us stay in their sector of the city to plan as they clean up the aftermath of the attack.
Most of them, he says.
Evelyn's expression turns flat. I'm afraid your father still commands the loyalty of many of them, and he advised them to avoid us when he came to visit a few days ago. She smiles bitterly.
And they agreed. Just as they did when he persuaded them to exile me.
They exiled you? Says Tobias. I thought you left.
No. The abnegation were inclined toward forgiveness and reconciliation, as you might expect. But your father has a lot of influence over the abnegation, and he always has. I decided to leave rather than face the indignity of public exile.
Tobias looks stunned. Edward, who has been leaning out the side of the car for a few seconds, says,
It's time.
See you in a week, Evelyn says. As the train dips down to street level, Edward leaps. A few seconds later, Evelyn follows. Tobias and I remain on the train, listening to it hiss against the rails, without speaking.
Why did you even bring me along if you were just going to make an alliance anyway?
I say flatly.
You didn't stop me.
What was I supposed to do, wave my hands in the air? I scowl at him.
I don't like it.
It has to be done.
I don't think it does, I say. There has to be another way.
What other way? He says, folding his arms.
You just don't like her. You haven't since you first met her.
Obviously I don't like her. She abandoned you.
They exiled her. And if I decide to forgive her, you had better try to do it too.
I'm the one who got left behind, not you.
This is about more than that. I don't trust her. I think she's trying to use you.
Well, it isn't for you to decide.
Why did you bring me again?
I say, mirroring him by folding my arms.
Oh, yeah, so that I could read the situation for you.
Well, I read it, and just because you don't like what I decided doesn't mean...
I forgot about how your biases cloud your judgment. If I had remembered, I might not have brought you.
My biases? What about your biases? What about thinking everyone who hates your father as much as you do is an ally?
This is not about him.
Of course it is. He knows things, Tobias, and we should be trying to find out what they are.
This again?
I thought we resolved this.
He is a liar, Triss.
Yeah?
I raise my eyebrows.
Well, so is your mother. You think the abnegation would really exile someone?
Because I don't.
Don't talk about my mother that way.
I see light up ahead. It belongs to the pyre.
Fine.
I walk to the edge of the car door.
I won't.
I jump out, running a few steps to keep my balance. Tobias jumps out after me, but I don't give him a chance to catch up. I walk straight into the building, down the stairs, and back into the pit to find a place to sleep.
Chapter 26.
Something shakes me awake.
Triss, get up!
A shout. I don't question it. I throw my legs over the edge of the bed and let a hand pull me toward the door. My feet are bare, and the ground is uneven here. It scrapes at my toes and at the edges of my heels. I squint ahead of me to figure out who's dragging me.
Christina.
She's almost pulling my left arm from its socket.
What happened? I say. What's going on?
Shut up and run! We run to the pit, and the roar of the river follows me up the paths. The last time Christina pulled me out of bed, it was to see Al's body lifted out of the chasm. I grit my teeth and try not to think about that. It can't have happened again. It can't.
I gasp. She runs faster than I do. As we sprint across the glass floor of the pyre,
Christina slams her palm into an elevator button and slips inside before the doors are fully open, dragging me behind her. She jabs the door close button, and then the button for the top floor.
Simulation, she says. There's a simulation. It's not everyone. It's just a few.
She puts her hands on her knees and takes deep breaths.
One of them said something about the Divergent, she says.
Said that?
I say. Well, under a simulation? She nods.
Marlene. Didn't sound like her, though. Too monotone.
The doors open, and I follow her down the hallway to the door marked roof access.
Christina, I say. Why are we going to the roof?
She doesn't answer me. The stairs to the roof smell like old paint. Dauntless graffiti is scrawled on the cement block walls in black paint, the symbol of Dauntless. Initials paired together with plus signs, RG plus NT, BR plus FH. Couples who are probably old now, maybe broken up. I touch my chest to feel my heartbeat. It's so fast, it's a wonder I'm still breathing at all. The night air is cool. It gives me goosebumps on my arms. My eyes have adjusted to the darkness by now. And across the roof I see three figures, standing on the ledge facing me. One is Marlene. One is Hector. One is someone I don't recognize. A young Dauntless, barely 8 years old with a green streak in her hair. They stand still on the ledge, though the wind is blowing hard, tossing their hair over their foreheads, into their eyes, into their mouths. Their clothes snap in the wind. But still they stand motionless.
Just come down off the ledge now, Christina says. Don't do anything stupid. Come on. Now.
They can't hear you, I say quietly as I walk toward them. Or see you.
We should all jump at them at once. I'll take Heck. You.
We'll risk shoving them off the roof if we do that. Stand by the girl just in case. She is too young for this, I think. But I don't have the heart to say it. Because it means Marlene is old enough. I stare at Marlene, whose eyes are blank like painted stones, like spheres of glass. I feel as if those stones are slipping down my throat and settling in my stomach, pulling me toward the ground. There is no way to get her off that ledge. Finally, she opens her mouth and speaks.
I have a message for the Divergent.
Her voice sounds flat. The simulation is using her vocal cords, but robs them of the natural fluctuations of human emotion. I look from Marlene to Hector. Hector, who was so afraid of what I am because his mother told him to be. Lynn is probably still at Shauna's bedside, hoping Shauna can move her legs when she wakes up again. Lynn can't lose Hector. I step forward to receive the message.
This is not a negotiation. It is a warning. Says the simulation through Marlene, moving her lips and vibrating in her throat. Every 2 days, until one of you delivers yourself to Erudite headquarters, this will happen again.
This. Marlene steps back, and I throw myself forward, but not at her, not at Marlene, who once let Uriah shoot a muffin off her head on a dare, who gathered a stack of clothing for me to wear, who always, always greeted me with a smile. No, not at Marlene. As Marlene and the other Dauntless girls step off the edge of the roof, I dive at Hector. I grab whatever my hands can find, an arm, a fistful of shirt. The rough rooftop scrapes my knees as his weight drags me forward. I am not strong enough to lift him. I whisper, "Help!" because I can't speak any louder than that. Christina is already at my shoulder. She helps me haul Hector's limp body onto the roof. His arm flops to the side, lifeless. A few feet away, the little girl lies on her back on the rooftop. Then the simulation ends. Hector opens his eyes, and they are no longer empty.
Ow,
he says.
What's going on?
The little girl whimpers, and Christina walks over to her, mumbling something in a reassuring voice. I stand. My entire body shaking. I inch toward the edge of the roof and stare at the ground. The street below isn't lit very well, but I can see Marlene's faint outline on the pavement. Breathing. Who cares about breathing? I turn from the sight, listening to my heartbeat in my ears. Christina's mouth moves. I ignore her. I walk to the door and down the stairs and down the hallway and into the elevator. The doors close. And as I drop to the earth, just as Marlene did after I decided not to save her, I scream, my hands tearing at my clothes. My throat is raw after just a few seconds, and there are scratches on my arms where I missed the fabric. But I keep screaming. The elevator stops with a ding. The doors open. I straighten my shirt, smooth my hair down, and walk out. I have a message for the Divergent. I am Divergent. This is not a negotiation. No, it is not. It is a warning. I understand. Every 2 days, until one of you delivers yourself to Erudite Headquarters, I will. This will happen again. It will never happen again.
Chapter 27.
I weave through the crowd next to the chasm. It's loud in the pit, and not just because of the river's roar. I want to find some silence, so I escape into the hallway that leads to the dormitories. I don't want to hear the speech Tori will make on Marlene's behalf, or be around for the toasting and the shouting as the Dauntless celebrate her life and her bravery. This morning, Lauren reported that we missed some of the cameras in the initiate dormitories, where Christina, Zeke, Lauren, Marlene, Hector, and Key, the girl with the green hair, were sleeping. That's how Janine figured out who the simulation was controlling. I do not doubt that Janine chose young Dauntless, because she knew their deaths would affect us more. I stop in an unfamiliar hallway and press my forehead to the wall. The stone feels rough and cool on my skin. I can hear the Dauntless shouting behind me, their voices muffled by layers of rock. I hear someone approaching and look to the side. Christina, still wearing the same clothes she wore last night, stands a few feet away. "Hey," she says. "I'm not really in the mood to feel more guilt right now, so go away, please. I just want to say one thing, and then I will." Her eyes are puffy, and her voice sounds a little sleepy, which is either due to exhaustion or a little alcohol, or both. But her stare is direct enough that she must know what she's saying. I pull away from the wall. I'd never seen that kind of simulation before. You know, from the outside. But yesterday, she shakes her head. You were right. They couldn't hear you. Couldn't see you. Just like Will. She chokes on his name. Stops, takes a breath. Swallows hard. Blinks a few times. Then looks at me again. You told me you had to do it. Or he would have shot you. And I didn't believe you. I believe you now. And I'm going to try to forgive you. That's all I wanted to say. There's a part of me that feels relief. She believes me. She's trying to forgive me, even though it won't be easy. But a larger part of me feels anger. What did she think before now? That I wanted to shoot Will? One of my best friends? She should have trusted me from the beginning, should have known that I wouldn't have done it if I had been able to see another option at the time. How fortunate for me that you finally got proof that I'm not a cold-blooded murderer. You know, other than my word, I mean. What reason would you have to trust that? I force a laugh, trying to stay nonchalant. She opens her mouth, but I keep talking, unable to stop myself. You better hurry on that forgiving me thing, because there isn't much time. My voice cracks, and I can't hold myself together anymore. I start sobbing. I lean against the wall for support and feel myself sliding down as my legs get weak. My eyes are too blurry to see, but I feel her when she wraps her arms around me and squeezes so hard it hurts. She smells like coconut oil, and she feels strong, exactly like she was during initiation into Dauntless, when she hung over the chasm by her fingertips. Back then, which was not so long ago, she made me feel weak. But now her strength makes me feel like I could be stronger, too. We kneel together on the stone floor, and I clutch her as tightly as she clutches me. "It's already done," she says. "That's what I meant to say. That the forgiving was already done." All the Dauntless go quiet when I walk into the cafeteria that night. I don't blame them. As one of the Divergent, I have the power to let Janine kill one of them. Most of them probably want me to sacrifice myself,
or they are terrified that I won't. If this were abnegation, no Divergent would be sitting here right now. For a moment, I don't know where to go or how to get there. But then Zeke waves me over to his table, looking grim, and I guide my feet in that direction. But before I make it there, Lynn approaches me. She's a different Lynn from the one I have always known. She doesn't have a fierce look in her eye. Instead, she is pale and biting her lip to hide its wobble. She says. She looks to the left, to the right, anywhere but my face. I miss Marlene. I've known her for a long time, and I... She shakes her head. The point is, don't think that my saying this means anything about Marlene, she says, like she's scolding me. But thank you for saving Heck. Lynn shifts her weight from one foot to the other, her eyes flickering around the room. Then she hugs me with one arm, her hand gripping my shirt. Pain shoots through my shoulder. I don't say anything about it. She lets go, sniffs, and walks back to her table like nothing happened. I stare at her retreating back for a few seconds, and then sit down. Zeke and Uriah sit side by side at the otherwise empty table. Uriah's face is slack, like he's not completely awake. He has a dark brown bottle in front of him that he sips from every few seconds. I feel cautious around him. I saved Heck, which means I failed to save Marlene. But Uriah doesn't look at me. I pull out the chair across from him and sit on the edge of it. Where's Shauna? I say. Still in the hospital? No, she's over there, says Zeke, nodding to the table Lynn walked back to. I see her there, so pale she might as well be translucent, sitting in a wheelchair. Shauna shouldn't be up, but Lynn's pretty messed up, so she's keeping her company. But if you're wondering why they're all the way over there, Shauna found out I'm Divergent, says Uriah sluggishly, and she doesn't want to catch it. Oh. She got all weird with me, too, says Zeke, sighing. How do you know your brother isn't working against us? Have you been watching him? What I wouldn't give to punch whoever poisoned her mind. You don't have to give anything, says Uriah. Her mother's sitting right there. Go ahead and hit her. I follow her gaze to a middle-aged woman with blue streaks in her hair, and earrings all the way down her earlobe. She is pretty, just like Lynn. Tobias enters the room a moment later, followed by Tori and Harrison. I've been avoiding him. I haven't spoken to him since that fight we had, before Marlene. Hello, Triss, Tobias says when I'm close enough to hear him. His voice is low, rough. It transports me to quiet places. Hi, I say in a tight little voice that does not belong to me. He sits next to me and puts his arm on the back of my chair, leaning close. I don't stare back. I refuse to stare back. I stare back. Dark eyes, a peculiar shade of blue, somehow capable of shutting the rest of the cafeteria out, of comforting me, and also of reminding me that we are farther away from each other than I want us to be. Aren't you going to ask me if I'm all right? I say. No, I'm pretty sure you're not all right. He shakes his head. I'm going to ask you not to make any decisions until we've talked about it. It's too late, I think. The decision's made. Until we've all talked about it, you mean, since it involves all of us, says Uriah. I don't think anyone should turn themselves in. No one? I say. No, Uriah scowls. I think we should attack back. Yeah, I say hollowly. Let's provoke the woman who can force half of this compound to kill themselves. That sounds like a great idea. I was too harsh. Uriah tips the contents of his bottle down his throat. He brings the bottle down on the table so hard I'm afraid it will shatter. Don't talk about it like that, he says in a growl. I'm sorry, I say, but you know I'm right. The best way to ensure that half our faction doesn't die is to sacrifice one life.
I don't know what I expected. Maybe that Uriah, who knows too well what will happen if one of us does not go, would volunteer himself. But he looks down, unwilling.
Torian Harrison and I decided to increase security. Hopefully if everyone is more aware of these attacks, we will be able to stop them, Tobias says. If it doesn't work, then we will think of another solution. End of discussion. But no one is going to do anything yet. Okay? He looks at me when he asks, and raises his eyebrows.
Okay, I say,
not quite meeting his eyes. After dinner, I try to go back to the dormitory where I've been sleeping, but I can't quite walk through the door. Instead, I walk through the corridors, brushing the stone walls with my fingers, listening to the echoes of my footsteps. Without meaning to, I pass the water fountain, where Peter, Drew, and Al attacked me. I knew it was Al by the way he smelled. I can still call the scent of lemongrass to mind. Now I associate it not with my friend, but with the powerlessness I felt as they dragged me to the chasm. I walk faster, keeping my eyes wide open so it will be harder to picture the attack in my mind. I have to get away from here, far from the places where my friend attacked me, where Peter stabbed Edward, where a sightless army of my friends began its march toward the abnegation sector, and all this insanity began. I go straight toward the last place where I felt safe, Tobias's small apartment. The second I reach the door, I feel calmer. The door is not completely closed. I nudge it open with my foot. He isn't there, but I don't leave. I sit on his bed and gather the quilt in my arms, burying my face in the fabric and taking deep breaths of it through my nose. The smell it used to have is almost gone. It's been so long since he slept on it. The door opens and Tobias slips in. My arms go limp, and the quilt falls into my lap. How will I explain my presence here? I'm supposed to be angry with him. He doesn't scowl, but his mouth is so tense that I know he's angry with me.
Don't be an idiot, he says.
An idiot? You were lying. You said you wouldn't go to Erudite and you were lying. And going to Erudite would make you an idiot. So don't.
I set the blanket down and get up.
Don't try to make this simple, I say. It's not. You know as well as I do that this is the right thing to do. You chose this moment to act like the abnegation? His voice fills the room and makes fear prickle in my chest. His anger seems too sudden, too strange. All that time you spent insisting that you were too selfish for them. And now, when your life is on the line, you've got to be a hero? What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? People died. They walked right off the edge of a building, and I can stop it from happening again. You're too important to just die.
He shakes his head. He won't even look at me. His eyes keep shifting across my face, to the wall behind me or the ceiling above me, to everything but me.
I'm too stunned to be angry.
I'm not important. Everyone will do just fine without me, I say.
Who cares about everyone? What about me?
He lowers his head onto his hands, covering his eyes. His fingers are trembling. Then he crosses the room in two long strides and touches his lips to mine. Their gentle pressure erases the past few months. And I am the girl who sat on the rocks next to the chasm, with river spray on her ankles, and kissed him for the first time. I am the girl who grabbed his hand in the hallway just because I wanted to. I pull back, my hand on his chest to keep him away. The problem is, I am also the girl who shot Will, and lied about it, and chose between Hector and Marlene, and now a thousand other things besides. And I can't erase those things.
You would be fine.
I don't look at him. I stare at his t-shirt between my fingers and the black ink curling around his neck. But I don't look at his face.
Not at first, but you would move on and do what you have to do.
He wraps an arm around my waist and pulls me against him.
That's a lie, he says, before he kisses me again.
This is wrong. It's wrong to forget who I've become, and to let him kiss me when I know what I'm about to do. But I want to. Oh, I want to. I stand on my tiptoes and wrap my arms around him. I press one hand between his shoulder blades and curl the other one around the back of his neck. I can feel his breaths against my palm, his body expanding and contracting. And I know he's strong, steady, unstoppable. All things I need to be. But I am not. I am not. He walks backward, pulling me with him, so I stumble. I stumble right out of my shoes. He sits on the edge of the bed and I stand in front of him. And we're finally eye to eye. He touches my face, covering my cheeks with his hands, sliding his fingertips down my neck, fitting his fingers to the slight curve of my hips. I can't stop. I fit my mouth to his, and he tastes like water and smells like fresh air. I drag my hand from his neck to the small of his back and put it under his shirt. He kisses me harder. I knew he was strong. I didn't know how strong until I felt it myself. The muscles in his back tightening beneath my fingers. Stop, I tell myself. Suddenly it's as if we're in a hurry. His fingertips brushing my side under my shirt. My hands clutching at him, struggling closer, but there is no closer. I have never longed for someone this way, or this much. He pulls back just enough to look into my eyes, his eyelids lowered. Promise me, he whispers, that you won't go. For me. Do this one thing for me. Could I do that? Could I stay here? Fix things with him? Let someone else die in my place? Looking up at him, I believe for a moment that I could. And then I see Will. The crease between his eyebrows. The empty simulation-bound eyes. The slumped body. Do this one thing for me. Tobias's dark eyes plead with me. But if I don't go to Erudite, who will? Tobias? It's the kind of thing he would do. I feel a stab of pain in my chest as I lie to him. Okay. Promise, he says, frowning. The pain becomes an ache, spreads everywhere, all mixed together, guilt and terror and longing. I promise. Chapter 28. When he starts to fall asleep, he keeps his arms around me fiercely, a life-preserving prison. But I wait, kept awake by the thought of bodies hitting pavement, until his grip loosens and his breathing steadies. I will not let Tobias go to Erudite when it happens again, when someone else dies. I will not. I slip out of his arms. I shrug on one of his sweatshirts so I can carry the smell of him with me. I slip my feet into my shoes. I don't take any weapons or keepsakes. I pause by the doorway and look at him, half buried under the quilt, peaceful and strong. I love you, I say quietly, trying out the words. I let the door close behind me. It's time to put everything in order. I walk to the dormitory where the Dauntless-born initiates once slept. The room looks just like the one I slept in when I was an initiate. It is long and narrow, with bunk beds on either side and a chalkboard on one wall. I see by a blue light in the corner that no one bothered to erase the rankings that are written there. Uriah's name is still at the top. Christina sleeps in the bottom bunk beneath Lynn. I don't want to startle her, but there's no way to wake her otherwise. So I cover her mouth with my hand. She wakes with a start. Her eyes wide until they find me. I touch my finger to my lips and beckon for her to follow me. I walk to the end of the hallway and turn a corner. The corridor is lit by a paint-splattered emergency lamp that hangs over one of the exits. Christina isn't wearing shoes. She curls her toes under to protect them from the cold. What is it? She says. Are you going somewhere? Yeah, I have to lie. Or she'll try to stop me. I'm going to see my brother. He's with the abnegation, remember? She narrows her eyes. I'm sorry to wake you, I say, but there's something I need you to do. It's really important. Okay, Tris, you're acting really strange,
Are you sure you're not?
I'm not. Listen to me. The timing of the simulation attack wasn't random. The reason it happened when it did is because the abnegation were about to do something. I don't know what it was, but it had to do with some important information, and now Janine has that information.
What?
She frowns.
You don't know what they were about to do. Do you know what the information is?
No. I must sound crazy. The thing is, I haven't been able to find out very much about this, because Marcus Eaton is the only person who knows everything, and he won't tell me. It's the reason for the attack. It's the reason. And we need to know it.
I don't know what else to say, but Christina is already nodding.
The reason Janine forced us to attack innocent people? She says bitterly.
Yeah. We need to know it.
I had almost forgotten. She was under the simulation. How many abnegation did she kill, guided by the simulation? How did she feel when she awoke from that dream a murderer? I've never asked, and I never will.
I want your help, and soon. I need someone to persuade Marcus to cooperate, and I think you can do it.
She tilts her head and stares at me for a few seconds.
Triss, don't do anything stupid.
I force a smile.
Why do people keep saying that to me?
She grabs my arm.
I'm not kidding around.
I told you. I'm going to visit Caleb. I'll be back in a few days, and we can make a strategy then.
I just thought it would be better if someone else knew about all this before I left. Just in case. Okay?
She holds my arm for a few seconds, and then releases me.
Okay, she says.
I walk toward the exit. I hold myself together until I'm through the door. And then I feel the tears come. The last conversation I'll ever have with her. And it was full of lies.
Once I'm outside, I put up the hood of Tobias's sweatshirt. When I reach the end of the street, I glance up and down, searching for signs of life. There is nothing. The cool air prickles in my lungs on the way in, and on the way out unfurls in a cloud of vapor. Winter will be here soon. I wonder if Erudite and Dauntless will still be at a standstill then, waiting for one group to obliterate the other. I'm glad I won't have to see it. Before I chose Dauntless, thoughts like that never occurred to me. I felt assured for my long lifespan, if nothing else. Now there are no reassurances, except that where I go because I choose to. I walk in the shadows of buildings, hoping my footsteps won't attract any attention. None of the city lights are on in this area, but the moon is bright enough that I can walk by it without too much trouble. I walk beneath the elevated tracks. They shudder with the movement of an oncoming train. I have to walk fast if I want to get there before anyone notices that I'm gone. I sidestep a large crack in the street and jump over a fallen streetlight. I didn't think about how far I would have to walk when I set out. It isn't long before my body warms with the exertion of walking and checking over my shoulder and dodging hazards in the road. I pick up the pace, half walking and half jogging. Soon, I reach a part of the city that I recognize. The streets are better kept here, swept clean with few holes. Far away I see the glow of Erudite headquarters, their lights violating our energy conservation laws. I don't know what I will do when I get there. Demand to see Janine? Or just stand there until someone notices me? My fingertips skim a window in the building beside me. Not long now. Tremors go through my body now that I am close, making it difficult to walk. Breathing is tricky too. I stop trying to be quiet, and let air wheeze in and out of my lungs. What will they do with me when I get there? What plans do they have for me before I outlive my usefulness and they kill me? I don't doubt that they will kill me eventually. I concentrate on forward motion, on moving my legs, even though they seem to be unwilling to support my weight. And then, I'm standing in front of Erudite headquarters. Inside, crowds of blue-shirted people sit around tables, typing on computers, or bent over books or passing sheets of paper back and forth. Some of them are decent people who do not understand what their faction has done. But if their entire building collapsed in on them before my eyes, I might not find it in myself to care. This is the last moment I will be able to turn back.